Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. By the way, so this is our last podcast for the month of June. I want to thank everybody. June was by far our biggest month for the Bulwark Podcast with more downloads than ever before. Of course, that means that we'll try to do better in July. And just a quick word about our newsletters, which also, I know that a lot of you are new subscribers to the newsletters based on the numbers, and we really appreciate that. Would strongly urge you to check them out. I have a piece this morning about Matt Gaetz and the deep thoughts of Matt Gaetz, who has this uncanny ability of taking every MAGA meme and turning it into the lowest common denominator cartoon version. I mean, do you remember about 100,000 deaths ago and he thought it would be hilarious to show up on the floor of Congress wearing a gas mask? Well, yesterday, when the Kens and Karens from St. Louis were brandishing their weapons, he tweeted out, "In Joe Biden's America, your job is illegal. You are locked in your home. Borders don't exist. MS-13 lives next door, and the police are not coming when the mob arrives. This is all of us." Which, this is Matt's contribution to the debate. But as it turns out, really, this is actually not all of us, unless you're a Brooks brother wearing, you know, Ken and Karen living in a mock Renaissance palazzo mansion in a private gated community and looking like you are an utter idiot. The other problem with this in Joe Biden's America is that this is actually Donald Trump's America. So I did my newsletter commenting that Matt Gaetz perhaps inadvertently has stumbled on kind of an interesting insight, how difficult it is for the president to be running as the firefighter when he has been the arsonist in chief. This is all happening on his watch. Also, if you check out today's Bulwark, we have something that would be in the category of a man bites dog. James Carville is actually, yes, that James Carville, the Raging Cajun, is actually in the Bulwark. He has written for the Bulwark. He has imagined what a Trump farewell speech would be. Look, Donald Trump is not withdrawing from this race. I'm going to lay this out. I'm willing to die on this hill that there's no way that Donald Trump is not going through with this race. But Carville has a little bit of fun imagining what the farewell dropping out speech might sound like. You might want to check that out. And Jonathan Last also has a piece about the election, a victory or a landslide. But obviously, we want to focus on the biggest story of the day. And this one is just not going away. The story about the Russian bounties, the New York Times reporting today, American officials provided a written briefing in late February to President Trump, laying out their conclusion that a Russian military intelligence unit offered and paid bounties to Taliban-linked militants to kill U.S. and coalition troops in Afghanistan. Two officials familiar with the matter said, "The investigation into the suspected Russian covert operation to incentivize such killings has focused in part on an April 2019 car bombing that killed three Marines." Okay, so what we're getting now are reports that, in fact, despite his denials, the president was briefed. There is a written record of that briefing. Whether he read it or not is a separate issue. And that they are beginning to connect the dots to specific Americans who were killed. Yesterday, Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth, who is a veteran who lost her leg fighting in Iraq as a helicopter pilot, took to the floor of the Senate and laid out the two possibilities here. This is what Senator Duckworth had to say yesterday.
"But there are two possible scenarios before us. Both are damning for the man who is supposed to be in charge. The first is that Trump was never actually looped in. In this case, ignorance isn't exculpatory. I didn't know that our adversary was helping kill American troops because no one told me is not an excuse for the commander-in-chief of the greatest military on earth. It is, in fact, a confession of incompetence. If he was truly never told, then that means that his own staff either believes he's so compromised by Russia or they consider him so counterproductive to the running of the country that they thought it necessary to hide critical information about our national security from him. And if it is true that those who knew of this threat of American lives failed to tell the president, then we should expect a president with such an affinity for firing senior officials to have no qualms about acting swiftly to remove the cabinet-level officials who failed to share this critical information with him. The second, far more likely option, is that they're covering for him, that Trump knew, that of course Trump knew, yet he still did not act. That this America First president went right on placing Russian interests ahead of American lives, kept on acting as Putin's lackey, trying to score Russia an invite back into what would be the G8, even as he learned that they were working with terrorists to target our troops.
Wow. So who better to talk about this whole question about what did the president know and when did he know it was a man who knows all about intelligence briefing, our good friend David Priest, the chief operating officer of Lawfare, who joins us now. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Charlie. I have to say that Tammy Duckworth put that really well.
Well, you know, this is breathtaking. So I want to walk through this. I know you've probably been a very, very busy man. Remind our listeners about your role, first of all, in delivering the daily briefs. And just give me a little bit of your credentials before we dive into this.
So I've had a few angles on intelligence and policy. I started out as a CIA analyst writing for the president's daily brief. That is, doing assessments of various things in primarily the Middle East and counterterrorism, pulling together the best assessments that I could to write for the president. That was back in the Clinton administration and carried forward into the George W. Bush administration. Then I was a PDB briefer. I was one of the people who took the president's daily brief downtown to the handful of senior officials that each president decides can see his PDB. For me, my daily customers were the Attorney General of the United States, John Ashcroft, and the FBI Director, Bob Mueller, also substituted for the briefer who went into the White House on a couple of occasions to brief National Security Advisor Condi Rice and her deputy, Steve Hadley. After that, I was a manager at CIA, and I edited pieces for the president's daily brief and got things to the president then. More recently, I guess, don't know how many years ago, but I decided to research and write the history of the PDB. And for that, I interviewed at the time every living former president, former vice president, former CIA director, and almost all of the former secretaries of defense and state and national security advisors to figure out what had gone on, and dug into the archives, both CIA archives and all of the presidential libraries. So with all of that as background, there are some things about the president's daily brief that are clearly relevant here that I'm sure we'll get to. But the main one I want to point out is the president's daily brief is the ultimate vehicle of getting information exactly like this assessment about the Russian bounties to the president of the United States. That is what it is designed for, to get this analysis to the president.
Okay. Now, there was some question because the White House is saying, well, there wasn't a consensus. There might have been some doubt about this. That's what they are saying. So is, in terms of the daily briefing, does everything have to be nailed down? What do you do with something that is, shall we say, maybe there may be some contentiousness about it? And I'm not saying that there is, in fact, in this case, because it does sound like it's pretty solid. But that would be their pushback, that because it was not absolutely certain, it was not in the presidential briefing.
Historically, traditionally, and I'll explain why I'm giving those caveats up front, but historically and traditionally, that is absolute garbage. The president's daily brief includes the best assessments on important issues for the president. And the criterion, above all others, the criterion for getting things into the president's daily brief is, does the president need to see this to get ahead of a threat to the United States or to give him an opportunity to benefit the national security of the United States? If it's absolutely known and it's absolutely certain and it's verified, which is a word that's been going around, which is never used in intelligence circles, then it's probably not in the PDB, because then it's not an issue of intelligence. Then it's an issue of fact. Intelligence deals with uncertainty. Intelligence deals with the unknown and the small windows we get into it. And then the assessments try to figure out what's going on with the proper caveats on confidence and things like that. So it is entirely possible, and it is in the long history of the PDB, the norm that assessments go into the president's daily brief, that there is not complete analytic consensus in the intelligence community about it. In fact, some presidents liked seeing and wanted the highlights of the disagreements between teams of analysts in the community, because that helped heighten the issue for them to show what information was more important or what issues of logic and explanation would matter more. Now, the caveats I put at the beginning are for a reason, because we don't know what this president's daily brief looks like. I have my strong suspicions that because the president's daily brief is tailored to each president, that they have made this PDB very short with bullet points, because the president has made clear he doesn't like to read long documents. Maybe he doesn't read at all. So I don't know what's going in the PDB now. And it's possible that they have put a restriction on the PDB saying the president doesn't like to read about disagreements. He doesn't want to handle nuance of analytic arguments. So we're not going to put anything into the PDB that isn't the consensus of the intel community. That's possible. I still doubt it, but it's at least a reasonable possibility given what we know about this president and what we know about the advisors around him who are willing to bend things a little bit to make sure that he doesn't rage at them.
Yeah, well, then, but this New York Times report does say, and they seem very specific, that this was in a written briefing in late February to President Trump. Now, this is one of those moments where the president has laid down a pretty bright line that he's never been briefed on this. He never heard of it about this. He and Vice President Pence are utterly clueless. So he's been on record. But, you know, they're now reporting that, and then people in the intelligence community are saying, no, it was a written briefing. It was in February. There's also suggestions that John Bolton himself had talked to the president about it. I guess, and let me just go back here to say that, is there any way in your experience that if there was this sort of intelligence, if there was intelligence that the Russians were in fact doing this, is there any way that officials would say, yeah, the president doesn't need to know that?
First, I'll correct something from a moment ago. I think I heard you say that the intelligence community is saying they briefed him on February 27th. The sourcing in that story, I don't recall exactly, but I do not think it was sourced to the intelligence community. I think it was sourced to something like officials familiar with the matter. And it's unclear who that is, of course, because they're not naming the sources, but I think it's just as likely as not, probably more likely, that it's from somewhere in the policy community. Many people at the Pentagon are very upset over this story, and I don't see any reason why the intelligence community would be the source of these leaks. So putting that aside, is the fact that Russian bounties, according to the opinions of at least a couple of intelligence agencies analysts, were being put on American soldiers' heads in Afghanistan, is that PDB worthy? Absolutely. This is the kind of thing that I would expect to be in the PDB. Look, when I was a briefer, we had to get up in the middle of the night to go in, read the draft PDB for that morning, prep to brief it, to answer likely questions from our customers. We had to gather supplemental material based on what we thought our customers would want to dig in deeper on. And every morning I would go in, and depending on the day, maybe 2 a.m., I would show up and I would see the draft PDB for that day. And I would look at the articles and some of the issues I was familiar with, some I wasn't. But I can totally imagine myself going in, opening that draft PDB, and seeing an article like this. Mm-hmm. This is exactly the type of thing you would see in it, because number one, it deals with Afghanistan, which is still a major theater of operations for us, and something that this president has been engaged on in terms of his efforts to negotiate with the Taliban. Number two, it involves attacks against U.S. forces. Now, not every potential attack against U.S. forces is worthy of bringing to the president's attention. If it's, you know, somebody on the street somewhere in Europe who's throwing bottles at servicemen as they walk by, that might not make threshold for the PDB. But when it's Russia putting bounties on the heads of Americans in Afghanistan as a play with the Taliban, that definitely elevates it to something that would normally get into the PDB.
The again, the alternatives here are so stark, and the way that Senator Duckworth laid it out, that if in fact the president was not told this, it raises so many questions. You know, would it be possible? Because I mean, based on what you're saying, is it seems inconceivable that they did not include this. But if they did not include it, is because there was sensitivity, because somebody said we don't want to upset the president with information about Russia, or they did not trust him with the information about Russia. There's no good case scenario here, is there? There's really no case in which you come out and say, that's the way the system worked. I'm really glad that the president is on top of this and doing his job.
All of the scenarios to explain this raise serious questions. Some of these questions are ones that we have asked since day one. Some of them are a little more specific to this situation. But I think Tammy Duckworth had the basic elements right. There are some nuances that raise other possibilities. For example, from the beginning, they said the president was not briefed on this. The president says, I was not briefed on this. Even the National Security Advisor's statement that came out, I believe, late last night says very clearly that, you know, the president was not briefed on this. Well, they could be playing semantic word games here. Briefed has two meanings. The way that some people hear the word briefing is as a synonym for oral briefing, which is walking into the Oval Office or the residence and saying, Mr. President, here is your briefing, and then they talk. And the president does seem to prefer those to written documents. So it is quite possible that he was not orally briefed on this particular issue. And that is what these White House officials are falling back to as a defense. If so, and if it also, as reporting says, it was in the printed daily brief, shame on them, because they're playing word games with us and hoping that that would make the story go away. And it simply hasn't. Now, the daily briefing, it called the president's daily brief, confuses it a bit because, yeah, it's not necessarily an oral briefing, although some presidents took an oral briefing with the written document. But the point is, the president doesn't need to schedule an oral briefing every day. And most presidents since the 1960s have not scheduled an in-person oral briefing with an intelligence community officer every day, because they have it in print and they can read it at their leisure during the day. The problem we have is reporting suggests this president doesn't read it. So in a way, there is one possible explanation of this that makes all of these things true, which is the president was not briefed on this because he chose not to read the document. Therefore, he was not technically briefed, and he did not have an oral briefing that highlighted it for him.
You know, this
serious question then is, why do we have a commander in chief who doesn't bother to read his intelligence?
Well, exactly. And that, by the way, is completely plausible given his disconnection with the business of governing. But you're right. That is not exculpatory. The fact that the president might have been handed this information and chose not to read it, that he just simply was not interested or engaged enough to do this. It's also interesting that in the last several days, I mean, a couple of developments. Number one, the denials coming from people like John Ratcliffe, you know, recently confirmed director of national intelligence. I mean, he issued a statement basically saying that the leaks about the matter were a crime, which is certainly not a denial. Gina Haspel, director of the CIA, also issued a statement that was clearly not a denial. And what's interesting is that no one from the White House has issued a statement saying, if true, this is what we would say about it. You know, there's no pushback. There's no criticism of Russia. It's interesting that the president is more interested in denouncing the New York Times than the possibility that the Russians were engaged in killing American troops.
Right. Imagine if we had I don't know how to say this in new terms, Charlie, but imagine if we had a normally functioning national security presidency. You would have one of two options right now if you're the president. If this information was supposed to have been brought to you, and let's say that your briefers, including the national security advisor, who presumably you see on a daily basis, if your advisors chose not to bring this to your attention, you've got some house cleaning to do, because that is dereliction of duty on the part of at least the national security advisor, possibly also leaders of the intel community, and possibly also the Secretary of Defense, who also gets the president's daily brief. So that's one option. In a normally functioning national security presidency, there's another option, which is that the president was briefed on this, but chose to take no action. In that case, it's incumbent upon the president to explain why. It would be possible in a different presidency to imagine that this information was brought to the president, and there have been policy deliberations going on at multiple levels, because let's be honest, this is a tricky problem. This is a difficult thing because there is no natural response that is obvious above all others. Maybe there's a long simmering policy process. Maybe the president is initiating some covert action or something else. That would be plausible in another presidency. The reaction of the president and the reaction of those around him suggests that that is not the case here. And in fact, we're back in that earlier scenario of a normally functioning presidency would see heads rolling at this point if they didn't alert the president, or you would be seeing resignations from senior officials if the president was alerted to this and has been not authorizing any action based on it.
Now, so far, this is where we're at in all of this, that the president obviously has to share some, you know, has to say something to Congress. And he did something that maybe we've just become numb to it. I know we use that phrase way too often, but that the president, rather than dealing with Congress, has chosen, at least up until now, to deal just with Republicans in Congress, which, again, this is one of those moments to step back and go, you know, Donald Trump is refusing to deal with the constitutionally designated, you know, second branch of government, or first branch, actually Article One, first branch of government. He's dealing with it solely on a partisan basis. This is not the way things are done, right? To just go and brief Republicans. But even that hasn't been enough to quash the story.
Yeah, that's not how
this
works.
You want to talk about that? I mean, what was disturbing about it is that he sees everything, including something like this, through a partisan spin lens. And you would hope that at least at this moment, we would really want to know what the truth is rather than hide behind the spin and count on the Matt Gaetzes and the Jim Jordans of the world, you know, to throw up, dust and bullshit.
Yep. Saying no to a president is hard. And that's true for any president. And most people, most presidents find it hard to get people who aren't yes men and yes women around them. But presidents traditionally have valued that. In this administration, it appears people have stopped trying to tame the president's worst instincts, or maybe they have their own bad instincts. When it comes to notifying Congress about matters of national security and intelligence, we have decades of experience doing that, even on the most sensitive matters. At the extreme, you could easily brief the Gang of Eight. You could brief the leadership of the House and Senate, both the majority and minority leaders. And you could brief the chairman and vice chairman of the intelligence committees. That is done on matters of extreme secrecy. Covert actions are often informed to congressional leadership in this way. Not every representative and senator learns about them, but that way someone in Congress is made aware of them. You can also just brief the intelligence committees themselves, which of course are bipartisan committees. That is normally the way these things are done. There are briefings going on every week where intelligence officers representing the executive branch, intelligence officers are going to Congress, briefing them on top secret intelligence. The system is built for that. And here you have perhaps the most compelling issue, the most serious and grave issue on national security that's come up in recent times. And you're bringing a group of Republicans to the White House to brief them, and you're having the chief of staff participate in that briefing. That's not the normal way to communicate the objectivity of this information. That is putting a politicization wrap on something that need not have it. I really don't see the benefit of doing it, not just the benefit in terms of communicating the information clearly. I don't see the political gain from this, because it doesn't make it look like anyone is politicizing it except the White House itself.
Oh, I see the political gain, which is that he knows, Trump understands, the Trump folks understand that he can't survive this if the public believes that this in fact happened and that he knew about it and did nothing about it. So he's got to do what he always does, which is to find a way to spin it, to change the subject, to cast doubt. And so, you know, they're already saying, well, there was no consensus, there was dissent, so therefore, all we need to do is plant that doubt there. And you know that then that you give, we'll have the talking points in the right hands who will be able to push this, to be able to deflect all of this. And then we'll move on to something else, because this is one of those. I mean, this is potentially deadly, because the details are very easy to understand, which is always a bad thing if you're the subject of it. You know, Russians paying to kill our soldiers. President either knew about it and did nothing, or is so out of the loop that he's clueless. That's bad. Veterans are livid. Ben Sasse issued a statement saying he's hearing about this from back home, and he used the word livid. And here's my question, though. There is going to be a paper trail at some point. You know, John Bolton's testimony could be a dagger on all of this. And so I understand why they could be. That's right. You don't know.
Could be, but we have one problem. And that problem is the same that we've experienced for years. And the problem's name is John Bolton. John Bolton has said he's not going to comment on what he briefed the president in 2019 when supposedly the early parts of this story were known, because he will not talk about classified information. Well, John Bolton has, of course, interesting back and forth on what he's willing to talk about and when and why. Maybe if there's another book contract, he'll seek to get this information cleared for publication. Yeah.
So are we ever going to see the daily brief?
It's funny. If you would have asked me this 10 years ago, I would have leaned on the side of no, because the standing practice back then was the PDBs are the crown jewels. They're right. The ultimate example of executive deliberation, and PDBs with a very few rare cases had never been declassified. What happened, unfortunately, as my book on the PDB was coming out, is the U.S. government changed its tune, and they decided on a 40-year declassification basis for PDBs. So the president's daily briefs and the predecessor documents from John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson were released publicly with a big conference down at the LBJ Library in Texas. And then a few years later, the Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford PDBs were rolled out because their 40 years had passed. Mm-hmm. Now, all of those PDBs are available. You can actually go and see what President Nixon was reading during the October War, or what Gerald Ford was reading about the situation in Vietnam in 1975. There are still some redactions. That is, there are still some things even 40 years later blacked out, because they reveal some sources or methods that are still relevant to national security now. But it's amazing the window you get into both sides of this, Charlie. On the one hand, you'll read some of those documents and you'll think, wow, you know, we really did understand what was going on in the Congo or Saudi Arabia. Or you can read it and say, that's it. That's what billions of dollars of intelligence were giving the president on this key issue, and that's all we could tell him. So you'll get a sense of that then. What we don't know is whether they will continue that practice, because in theory, this year, we should be seeing the beginning of the rollout of the Jimmy Carter PDBs, because his term ended in January 1981, and that hits 40 years. We don't know if this president, because it is a presidential prerogative, if this president is going to continue the 40-year declassification process.
So though it sounds like, though, what you're saying is that we are not going to see this PDB. We're not going to know. We're not going to get a copy of the one from all, almost certainly not. So, okay, now here.
Let me give you one exception to that.
Okay, how many people, I don't mean legally, how many people actually get their hands on all of this? I guess where I'm going is, what are the potentials for a leak? It is illegal. It would be illegal, which is why John Ratcliffe is out there basically, you know, throwing, you know, high hard ones against anybody thinking of doing it. But so how widely disseminated is this document?
Yeah, right on. Let's put it out there. You know, top secret intelligence should not be leaked, period. Yes, this story is important. It gives a window into the presidency. That's all very good. But it is not good that it came from somebody talking about the actual intelligence information. There's a reason why it's top secret information. And that's almost always the sources and the methods. That is the people giving us this information. We need to protect their identities so that they can continue to give us information to protect national security. Mm-hmm. And the methods by which we gather that information are very tightly held. And if those methods are given up, then that makes it harder to collect intelligence in the future. So that is a bad thing. How many people have access to it? Well, there's one group that generally doesn't have access to the president's daily brief, even though they have access to much of the intelligence that would inform the PDB. And that's Congress. Congress does not get the president's daily brief. Congress has sought to get copies of the president's daily brief before during investigations, and they have been routinely unsuccessful because the executive branch simply says, no, this is the pinnacle of executive deliberation.
How do we then resolve this? How do we definitively, or do we ever definitively, answer the question, what did the president know and when did he know it?
There's a few ways. One is the president or those around him can say, look, we are going to do a selective declassification to show you what we knew and when we knew it. That right now appears unlikely because reporting suggests it would be damning. Reporting suggests that it would show the president had some intelligence that indicated the severity of this and nothing has happened as a result. But it's possible that the way it's written up is actually very highly caveated. It's expressed with low confidence and it is not something that looks the way it does on a headline on a newspaper. So they could selectively declassify this and put it out there. Another way is to have massive public pressure, because the only way that PDBs were made public was after the 9/11 commission came out, because the pressure from the families of the victims of 9/11 were such that the 9/11 commission was allowed to examine the president's daily brief and declassify two of them in their entirety and put them into the 9/11 report. That's unlikely because that takes a lot of time and a lot of momentum. And I certainly don't want 3,000 U.S. deaths in Afghanistan or elsewhere happening in order to drive public momentum for that. Short of that, we're unlikely to see what was actually in there unless somebody within the White House, within DOD, or somewhere else in the government chooses to leak what was in that PDB. That is also unlikely because copies of the PDB aren't just floating around. They are usually kept very tightly. So I am not confident we will know exactly what was said unless the administration decides to selectively declassify it.
What about a whistleblower? So let me read you the AP story here, and then we'll get to the whistleblower. So they're saying the White House was aware all the way back in 2019. This is where we get to Bolton. Top officials in the White House were aware in early 2019 of classified intelligence indicating Russia was secretly offering bounties to the Taliban for the deaths of Americans a full year earlier than has previously been reported, according to U.S. officials, plural, with direct knowledge of the intelligence. The assessment was included in at least one of President Trump's written daily intelligence briefings at the time. Then the National Security Advisor John Bolton also told colleagues at the time that he briefed Trump on the intelligence assessment in March 2019. They were, of course, not responding. Bolton declined to comment, as you mentioned. When asked by the AP if he'd briefed Trump about the matter on Sunday, he suggested NBC that Trump was claiming ignorance of Russia's provocations to justify his administration's lack of response. He can disown everybody if nobody ever told him about it, Bolton said. So, you know, we're getting at this drip, drip, drip of revelations casting doubt on Trump's efforts to distance themselves from this Russian intelligence assessment. So is it possible that there would be a whistleblower who would be able to come and tell Congress what happened or no?
This is almost a categorical no. Whistleblowing is a protected process for revealing illegal or certain other categories of information. What we're talking about here is not illegal. The president of the United States can receive intelligence, which again, by definition, is not certainty, but can receive intelligence about a threat and not respond to it. Right. Not responding is a choice, but there is a strategic reason for not responding to every threat.
In theory,
we may collectively, and it may be in polling 100% of the American public, minus one, the president, who thinks that something should have been done, but that's a policy choice. And the remedies for that are not whistleblowing, which is to reveal illegal activity. The remedies for that are either impeachment, because the president is unfit, because they're making bad choices, or voting them out at the next election. Whistleblowing does not apply here, with some possible exceptions which seem unlikely, which is, let's say that this was brought to the president's attention and he decided not to act on it. And then he started firing everybody who was aware of it. He ordered presidential documents destroyed. If it starts getting into a cover-up, then whistleblowing might apply. Right now, it's just information about intelligence that seems intelligence, the way it's been reported, that logic suggests should have been responded to in a different way, not an issue for whistleblowing.
Yeah, this is what makes you, and thanks for that clarification. I mean, what makes this so deadly, I think, for Trump is not just that it revives questions about Russia, and he's already talking about this being the second Russia hoax, but it revives all of those questions about what is his relationship with Putin? Why is he so deferential to Vladimir Putin? Are we going to have another case where he's going to side with Putin over American intelligence agencies? But I think what gives this the real power, obviously the real power, is the fact that it is so tangible, because we are talking about specific Americans who may have been killed. And so this raises the question, did the president betray not just the country, but did he betray the men and women in uniform? And this goes right to the heart of Trump's claim to put America first, to be the pro-military, the guy who supports the troops. And that's why I think this is not going to go away. And this could actually do significant damage, because the people who will be most outraged about this will be people who are also probably more likely than not inclined to support the president. This is something that goes right to the heart of his appeal and to his, I hate to use the word brand here because that seems so inappropriate, but you know what I mean.
Yep. On the Russia side, the reasons for his lack of a reaction, the reasons for this could be different, but they're all disturbing. One of them is he simply believes Russia over his own intelligence agencies. This would be in line with what happened in Helsinki, Finland, when he sided publicly with Putin over his intelligence, in which case you have to ask why. And those are reasonable questions. The other possible explanation is that he's not just reflexively saying Russia is always right, and if they deny it, I believe them. But it is possible that he was not orally briefed on this, and it was a conscious choice of senior officials, both intelligence and policy officials, not to bring it to his attention, because they were afraid of what he would do or not do with it if he were made aware of it. That
I know.
That is disturbing in its own way, because
that's also damning. Yes,
taking away the power of the presidency because you don't trust the person occupying the chair.
No, and I think that's the point that Tammy Duckworth was making as well. That doesn't make you feel any better, because it basically means that the people around you doubt your capacity to, you know, perform your fundamental task, which is to protect the American people and to protect the country. Okay, let's switch gears just a little bit, because I mean, you feel once again like there is the stars aligning. Major stories, the story over the last several weeks, the return of the coronavirus, the infection rate just skyrocketing in certain areas of the country. Deaths tend to be a lagging indicator. But you look at the chart, and I'm sure you've seen this chart, which is so disturbing and powerful. Tracking the decline of infections in much of the rest of the world, including Europe. And then there's the American line, which has broken out and is continuing to go up. This strikes me as the second phase of our public policy failure. We've made the case that the Trump administration, failed on multiple occasions early on, but there are excuses that you could provide for the initial failure to take it seriously. This seems right now to be the result of specific policy decisions, political decisions that were made in the face of overwhelming evidence. But and here we're at. Experts said, don't do it. Don't open up. You've got to wear the mask. You have to take this seriously. Don't declare a victory. And the president and his folks decided that they were going to ignore that they were going to open it up. It was going to be the transition back to greatness. And they bet everything on this thing going away. And it is catastrophically failing.
You know, they've proven the old adage, ignoring a problem doesn't make it go away. And the idea at the beginning was, yes, we're out there. Remember those daily briefings at the White House?
Yeah. Where
they were out there briefing on the situation. And whether those briefings were well done or not is subject for another day. I believe actually you and I talked about it one of those other days, but they were actually treating it like an issue that was front page news. And then all of a sudden they decided, we're not going to talk about this anymore. We're going to just gonna move on and hope it goes away. Of course, people were still working on it behind the scenes, but there is something important about the power of the presidency, regardless of who is occupying it, the power of the presidency to galvanize public attention to something. And if not for a pandemic, then what? Because this was something that if the president would have surprised all of us, and at any point from February till last week said, you know what, I've reflected on this and I've listened to the experts, and every American should be taking this more seriously than I implied earlier on. Everybody wear a mask. Yes, it will be uncomfortable for some of you. That's fine. But if we're okay sending our kids to school with bulletproof backpacks to protect freedom, I don't think we can complain about wearing a mask for 10 minutes walking into Target or Walmart. Let's just do this. And we'll get through a rough couple of months together, America, but we can save hundreds of thousands of lives, and that's worth a little bit of inconvenience. Now, nobody expected the president to say that just based on the nature of the person. But if he would have, that would have been a use of the presidency for something good, rather than just hoping it would go away and leading to what I hear some people calling a second wave. I don't think it's even a second wave. We never got out of the first wave.
Well, you know, have you noticed that Mike Pence is actually changing his tune on this, said that people ought to wear masks. Now, of course, he's very inconsistent in his own use of the mask and has been very slow. But you do get the sense that there is the growing recognition, even in Trump world, that this thing is bad and they're going to have to come up with some response other than complete denial. So what do you make of Mike Pence? At least beginning to move, having had that horrific press conference where it was all happy talk and he got very bad reviews. And obviously people are looking at the numbers and then juxtaposing it to what he's saying and realizing how utterly out of touch and misleading his comments are. Apparently he was maybe actually embarrassed by that.
Mike Pence is probably one of the most fascinating character studies that will be done when this presidency is over, because Pence in theory has a political future. Pence certainly had his own connections. And yet what he has done publicly in this presidency is nothing but back the president. So in this case, there is a sliver of daylight between what he is saying and what the president is or isn't saying. It's not a major difference. It's almost a matter of a slight emphasis. And yet it looks like a profile in courage all of a sudden. I think that says more about us than it does about him. I think it shows that our standards have declined so much that somebody says something that seems somewhat reasonable there, and we think that this is momentous. But if it is in fact a trial balloon of sorts to say, how far can we actually push this? Because by all accounts, the vice president is spending more time with the coronavirus experts than the president himself. If he is actually coming around and he's trying to see how far he can move things in the right direction, it doesn't forgive some of the other things he's done, but it certainly is the right thing to do at this point to try to save more lives.
But I think the president is actually stuck here. I think that people underestimate Trump's ability to lead or his willingness to lead. The die is cast, and you look at the public opinion polls, you watch social media, and the Trump base has already decided that they're not going to take this seriously, that they're not going to wear masks, that masks is somehow a sign of weakness or of political allegiance. And so once the president has planted that idea and it's taken such root, you would have to imagine him taking a step that would create distance between himself and the MAGA base. And one thing we have learned about Donald Trump is that he will not do that. You know, those are his people, you know, and he may be the leader, but in this case now they have followed his lead, but he needs to follow them. So I don't know what he's going to do. Interesting side note, of course, is the city of Jacksonville, where they're going to be holding the Republican National Convention, has just passed an ordinance mandating the use of masks at all indoor facilities. The RNC says it's going to comply. So I'm trying to imagine what a Republican convention with everybody wearing masks will look like. Donald Trump will never wear a mask in public. I'm just going to predict that right now. I just cannot imagine.
Hey, the president won't like that visual. He's been trying to avoid any visual of him with people with masks around him, including the mask factory itself. But I got to tell you, Charlie, you look at a map of the United States in the last few days that shows the rise in the rates of infections and presumably deaths. And it is not a direct correlation, but it is very highly correlated with the states that have the highest polling in support of the president. And that's an interesting dynamic because we've talked before about how things look different when you're watching the president on TV and you're reading his tweets and you're seeing him not just go at the libs, because I don't think that's what it's about anymore, just somebody who's aggressively saying and doing whatever he wants, and you feel empowered by that. In theory, that's one thing. When you actually have people in your family, in your workplace, people in your church dying, and you don't see the president taking it seriously, that's one of the few things that might actually move some people. You say he's more concerned about that deep base. This is now hitting his deep base. It's not New York that's seeing a rise in infection. It's not Virginia that's seeing a rise in infection, or DC. It's the deep South in many cases that are seeing the highest rates of infection growth.
Yeah, I want to just comment on this because I know there are a lot of folks out there who are saying, well, what is the role of the Black Lives Matter public protests? Because and there was it felt like a double standard where many of the same people were saying, do not congregate in large numbers, then applauded these mass protests where there was minimal social distancing. And so I am open to the criticism of those rallies. However, as you're looking at the map, and I actually spent some time on this because some people who I really generally respect, I do respect, are saying, you know, we have to take into account the role of these protests. And yet you're not seeing the spike in New York City or Washington, D.C. right now. I didn't look at Washington, D.C. or Minnesota. You are seeing it in places like Arizona and Florida. So I'm not sure that we actually have the correlation. I am open to that, to say that the protests, as well as the premature reopening of businesses, but it does seem as if it is disproportionately hitting these red states right now. And there doesn't seem to be a direct correlation between the cities where there were the protests. Now, I am open to being corrected on all of this.
I've seen the same data that Minneapolis, D.C. have not seen large rises in infection rates, but it stands to reason. And I'm, you know, if you apply what the scientists say to one group, you have to apply it to another group. So it stands to reason that if the guidance is wear a mask, if you're within, let's say, 6 feet of other people, because there is a higher chance of infection just through droplets in the air, it stands to reason that there are some people who got infected during these protests. Some people.
Yeah, sure.
Because it was outside, because so many of the protesters were masked, that probably helps explain why there has not been a larger rise in the areas with large demonstrations. In areas that did not have large demonstrations, we are seeing massive rises in infection rates. That probably has more to do with the opening of bars, restaurants. We've all seen the scenes from some of the beaches in the Southeast where people were shoulder to shoulder without, and you didn't see a mask in the picture. So I think both can be true, but we have to be honest about it, which is, yes, people who went to protest, and if they were on a crowded street, shoulder to shoulder with other protesters, singing, screaming, and they weren't wearing a mask, they likely exposed themselves to the virus. Yeah. That can also be true without having to say that there's no right to protest.
So, I mean, you know, from Trump's point of view, this is the alignment of all of the horrible stars, because the one thing, at least in the polls, where he is doing reasonably well is on the economy. But I think that's also one of those lagging indicators. You can't bring the economy back without dealing with the pandemic. And as the recognition begins to spread and to deepen, that in fact we are not past this thing, that in fact we are experiencing in many ways the worst case scenario, that's going to have tremendous economic consequences. So forget about the V-shaped recovery. But I think the real tragedy here is twofold. Number one is, of course, the politicization of masks, which is an indication of how deep this divide and tribalization has become, but also the universalization of skepticism. You know, you and I talked about this, we've talked about this for years, about the annihilation of truth, you know, what happens in a society in which there is so much fake news, misinformation, gaslighting. You get to a point where people just do not know what to think, who to believe. Right. And I think we're at that moment right now. And I think I saw Anthony Fauci give an interview saying he's just sort of stunned at the number of people who don't believe experts, who don't believe the science, who won't look at the data. And this has real world consequences in a very deadly way.
And it's amazing the contrast between the concern for human life in some regards and not others. I can't put it any better than George Takei, the Star Trek actor who probably should be better known for his remarkable book about his experience being put in an internment camp as a kid during World War II. He wrote, "The fragility of folks who won't wear a mask is truly breathtaking. I lived for 4 years inside two internment camps, and I heard less bitching and whining there than I do today."
That's a great note. David Priest, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast to talk about this. You were the perfect guest to talk about the whole presidential daily briefing. So thanks for coming back again.
Anytime.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and I think we'll have a very, very interesting podcast for you.